coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. It's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11. Co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studios in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, our guests are Lewis Nelson, professor of architectural history and the associate dean in the School of Architecture at the University of Virginia. His current research looks at enslavement in West Africa and the Americas. He is also studying the University of Virginia as a landscape of slavery and a lot more. And we have Seth Whispleway, directing minister at Restoration Village Arts, which provides space for artists and ministers in the pursuit of social justice. He's a grassroots organizer, educator, and pastor. If you have questions for our guests during the show, message us on Facebook at 947WPVC, and we'll take your questions. And also on that website, you'll find the Apropos show with all of our past 21 shows. And Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. And speaking of 21, you realize we, well, this being 22, but we are double the Scaramucci unit of 10 days, you know, of 10.
We've outlasted the Mooch.
Yeah, I think that he will, I'm sure he will, live on as a measure of, like a unit of measurement, excuse me, some sort of, you've done, how many Scaramucci's have we lived through, or are you lasted longer than three of him, or, honestly, I think we're all going to get drafted into the White House Communications Director Service at some point for our 10 days, you know.
You know, there was a lot, I wasn't really going to talk about it, but there was a lot going on at that moment, and you just
there
can't.
There is?
There, no, there was okay. At the moment that whole thing happened for 10 days, or like one day, one of the major days, and
yeah.
Also the trans ban was the testimony of this guy Browder, who was connected, I think, I don't know how to say the name, Magnitsky.
The
guy who got murdered, he was working closely with that guy, and he testified at the Senate. And it was, I would just recommend looking at that because it could be like one of the most important testimonies so far, anyway. And, you know, never miss an opportunity this week to denigrate the icons and the tenets of our democracy with the Statue of Liberty.
That's I thought you were going for the dump in the White House. I'm sorry. Yes, yeah. I know. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, the latest racist policy, who is better to traipse that out than a racist anti-Semite like Stephen Miller?
Ellen, you're sounding
also,
so cosmopolitan.
I know, I'm so cosmopolitan. And he was talking about English.
You better watch it.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah, it's so anti-Semitic, that phrase. He was talking to Jim Acosta. And, you know, one of the rules for you to be allowed into this country now under that policy would be that you have to speak English. So I'm wondering if Trump even qualifies.
Touche. Would he have gotten in? Would he have made it? I know. I'm pretty sure he would have gotten that mark that a physician needed to do something to test his eyes or whatever.
Right.
I know. I agree. As you know, to your point, now affirmative action has now been re-engineered to be reading, writing, and racism. You know, they don't know how to run a government, but they sure are superb at making most people's lives, excuse me, incredibly miserable. He does not, you can't underestimate what he's capable of. And I wish the founding fathers, though I get that they certainly considered someone someone not qualified could wind up at the top job. I wish they would have devised like a recess president. It would be really nice while he's in New Jersey to get someone in there that knows what they're doing.
And speaking of recess, let's do another bravo for Senator Murkowski from the Republican from Alaska. She locked in a pro forma mini session, so there'll actually be no recess. So that BLOTUS can't replace Sessions while they're on break. That was really good.
I know. And, you know, speaking of the Statue of Liberty, you know, I know there were so many messages with Miller's, dismissing of that poem, but honestly, they've wired me so that the first thing I thought is, oh, yeah, because a woman wrote it, you know, it doesn't count. You know, so to your point, yes, there are some strong women that are, just strong Americans. I get it, but it's just she's very impressive. Considering I know she's Republican and she's one of just a few Republican women out there. It was amazing
to really stand up to him because he really called her out and humiliated her. And did you say that were you talking about Emma Lazarus? The bring us your tired, your huddled masses. She's also Jewish, which I don't think I realized that.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's great.
It's just a great pinata for them. I mean, he's just up there. You could tell, right? He's just up there looking for a fight. That's all they know how to do is just have a fight. You know, roll up their sleeves and go out there and it's just.
Yeah. We could just go on and on.
Okay.
We have to pivot. So one event I wanted to talk about, it's actually a series of Resist the Pipelines in Virginia. I think everyone who drinks water in Virginia is affected by that. And there are a bunch of things to do, hearings. There's one this Monday from 6 to 10 p.m. at JMU. And the Indivisible Charlottesville Facebook page has tons of info on all that stuff. You can do everything from writing, submitting your personal testimonies, and it really matters. I think the publicity that we've been getting, meaning us, just all the people of this country, is really, I think, been working. So, vive la résistance.
It sounds great. I'm glad you mentioned it. I'm sorry. You had something else.
No, I was just going to move on to our yet. Amazing.
You're trying to run the show?
I'm trying to run it.
No.
The controls are here.
So not what we're doing these days. We're not doing anything anymore. It's all dysfunction. Anyway, I'm sorry. Yes, you were saying.
Well, despite that, we are functioning very well here. We have our first guest is Lewis Nelson. He is a professor of architectural history and associate dean in the School of Architecture at the University of Virginia. His wide-ranging scholarship includes the built environments of the early modern Atlantic world, the American South, the Caribbean, and West Africa, the role of visual culture in the formation of a national body politic, and theories and practices of sacred space. He's currently working to document and interpret the buildings and landscapes that shaped the transatlantic slave trade. He is researching the University of Virginia as a landscape of slavery.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Welcome, Lewis.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, I wanted to talk first about, I think, what's most pertinent for the people in this town, Thomas Jefferson's Academical Village. What's going on there? What kind of work are you doing?
Sure. So it's exciting for me to talk about a book project that I've been involved with over the last few years, a collective including an archaeologist, an art historian, a couple of historians, and myself as a landscape and architectural historian. About 2.5 years ago, really made the commitment, seeing the emergence or the soon arrival of the bicentennial of the University of Virginia, to try to take that opportunity to mark a transition in the way that we tell the history of the University of Virginia, which for, I assume most of our listeners will know that the particular narrative has been largely one-sided over the writing through the 20th century. And the gathering of these various disciplines gives us this great opportunity to really recast and reframe the way we understand the history of the University of Virginia, and to use both the kind of discrete documents, much of the hidden documentation, the stuff that has been sort of secreted out, and then also a lot of evidence from the buildings themselves and from the archaeological record. And we've been gathering that data really for the last 2 years very intensively, and have been writing a manuscript, and have actually just recently sent the manuscript off to press.
What sorts of rooms or spaces have you uncovered so far? Because I know you're still there.
Yeah, it's great. So one of the things that we all know that Thomas Jefferson had this real conflicted relationship with slavery and ideologies of democracy, and one of the things that he really wanted to try to establish was this kind of ideal space of the academical village. And when you're on the lawn of the academical village, what you're seeing there largely is that ideology of education, and it's really it's a white space. He would never, of course, use that phrase, but it is a white space. You're standing on the lawn. You're looking at lawn rooms that would have been occupied by exclusively white male students. You're looking at pavilions that would have been occupied by white families. And you really have to go just beyond the edges of that to begin to see where the white space intersects with black space and with landscapes of slavery. And so one of the things that many folks who go to the University of Virginia are deeply enamored with the beautiful gardens that are behind the pavilions. Those gardens are all installed in 1948. As a part of a colonial revival project, and they really mask these extraordinary landscapes of labor that would have previously occupied those spaces. And as Ben Ford is an archaeologist here in Charlottesville, and he's been doing extraordinary work for about 20 years, really unrecognized work, and he's been gathering just little bits and pieces sort of windows into how those yard spaces behind the pavilions actually functioned, because there were smokehouses, there were slave quarters, there were kitchens, there were all kinds of things that we associate with plantations. They were all there at the academical village, and as their use declined with the rise of the modern kitchen, those functions moved internal to the pavilion kitchens, and those spaces became largely abandoned by the early 20th century. And so by the 1940s, we see these gardens installed.
So what would you see as being done with them as some kind of a, I don't know what word to use, a showcase, mm-hmm. or to show people ultimately, what could they be turned into? What's your vision for that space?
Well, so there's a complicating factor there, because, of course, those gardens were installed in 1948. They are now themselves actually part of the historical record. And the move to build the monument to enslaved labor has, as part of that program, the reclaiming of one of the very few spaces that survives, and that's a kitchen building behind Pavilion 9. That kitchen building, the plan is to repurpose that kitchen building as an interpretive center, together with a newly installed interpretive center in the basement of the rotunda. And that's going to really help to better explain the complexity of movement. I mean, just as Thomas Jefferson wanted to make invisible the laboring landscapes of slavery at Monticello by submerging them behind the hill, it's exactly the same spatial strategy at the University of Virginia. And so what we want to try to do is to reclaim some of those spaces as a way of getting people to see the academical village from the edges towards the interior. One of the tools we're using is working with IATH, which is a digital research lab in Alderman Library. It's part of the University of Virginia Libraries. And we're reconstructing a digital model of the academical village. And what this allows us to do is to fully erase all of the gardens and begin to reinstall the kitchens and the smokehouses and the slave quarters. And so that's a visualizing technique, but it also has raised for us the opportunity to really begin to look at surveillance strategies. And so what we've done is we've reconstituted the mid-19th century terrain. We've repopulated two of the gardens. We've done the work with thus far with two of the gardens. We've repopulated those gardens with a recreation of their sort of 1840s and 1850s landscape. And then we make the model 2 o'clock in the morning, so it's black. And we put a little light behind each of the windows that would have been occupied by white space, so white spaces within the pavilions. We turn those lights on, and that creates for us a gray zone within the yard to see what spaces and what zones within the yard were more highly visible from white occupied spaces and what spaces were less visible from white occupied spaces. And so this begins to use digital technology as a way of better understanding how an African American in the context of slavery, recognizing that they were always being surveilled, how might they have navigated the spaces. And so it's based on the historical record, but the historical record is not a written record. And this is where it's so important for us, if we're actually going to begin to successfully reconstruct these landscapes of slavery from the 18th and the 19th centuries, we've got to use we have to see the written record through a different lens. We've got to look at the very edges of the written record, and then we also have to use creative ways of understanding the surviving material evidence.
What have you learned, Lewis, so far about the life of the slaves who built the university? Like, how long did they work for their white professors or their families and students?
We've learned a lot. And it's important for us also to recognize that when we're talking about slavery at the University of Virginia, we're really talking about two different periods. There's the period of construction, and so the individuals who are engaged in the enslaved labor of construction are not the same individuals that are engaged in the labor of service. And so slavery at the University of Virginia really needs to be understood as occupying these two different zones. Through the period of construction, Thomas Jefferson and a number of the other executors for the construction of the academical village employed white builders in the region, and those white builders then had teams of both free and enslaved laboring individuals who would then come together to build certain portions of the academical village. And we know at this point dozens, if not even scores, of individuals who were involved in the actual construction. And then at the time of the opening of the academical village, those folks go away, and the hotel keepers, and so the hotels are those buildings around the outside edges, and the hotels were the places where the students were fed, and their rooms were cleaned, and a whole different body of individuals come in to provide all the necessary services, because Jefferson refused to allow students to bring their own enslaved individuals.
We're talking with Lewis Nelson, professor of architectural history and associate dean in the School of Architecture. So, question I'm wondering, was there any politics involved, and why now? Why do you think this is possible now? Is this something new, or is there something going on right now, possibly in the environment, in society, where this is okay? Did you have any problems along the way?
Yeah, no, I think in some ways this is just the natural generational change, both in leadership of the university, but also in the kind of academic tradition. There are a large number of faculty at the University of Virginia now who are doing research in these kinds of areas, and the tenor of the education at the university really attends to many of these issues really well. So I've not gotten myself or my colleagues have gotten a resistance to this particular narrative. It's just that it's the predominant narrative has been so overwhelming for so long that this is really just a kind of watershed. And the watershed moment really is the last, you know, it's been the last 5 or 6 years.
What, when you were describing all that digital stuff and the lighting, it made me wonder if, have you yet found any signs that the slaves and students' lives overlapped in any of the spaces at school?
Yes, this turns up both in the physical record as well as in the written record. One of the chapters of our book focuses specifically on issues of violence. And one of the things you have to understand is that most of the students, the white male late teens, early 20s students that are occupying the academical village, are coming from landscapes of slavery in which they are absolutely the boss. They arrive here at the academical village in which they are not allowed to have their own personally owned enslaved individual. And so they begin to behave as if the entirety of the enslaved population is their own. And so there are numerous instances of beatings, of violence, and we're documenting that in one particular chapter. And most of that comes from the written record. The archaeological record also, and the architectural record, demonstrates pretty clearly that there's the reconstruction of a lot of these basement spaces as a way of changing the way Jefferson intended the spaces to move, and who can go into what space. The enslaved individuals are actually changing those spaces themselves, and we're going to be telling that story in the book.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Apropos of Something. We're going to a break. We're speaking with Lewis Nelson. We'll talk more with him about his work, and also Seth Wispelway, director, founding director and minister at Restoration Village Arts. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Lewis Nelson from UVA about architectural history.
Hey, Lewis, in terms of the slaves after they were freed, what was the environment like there, and what were some of the changes made at school?
Thanks for asking. So our book is actually is ending at the beginning of the Civil War. So the current research project that we're working on and publishing really just brings us up to the beginning of the Civil War. But there's actually been quite a lot of research on the post-Civil War experience of African Americans in Charlottesville. And Kurt Von Dack's recent book is a great way to get to that.
I wanted just to shift a little bit to your work. You've done a lot of work in Jamaica, and you have a new book out. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So in 2004, I started running a field school with UVA students in Jamaica, and we go live in this small town called Falmouth on the north coast of Jamaica for about 5 weeks every summer. And I started out with just five or six students, and by the end it was 20 or 25 students every summer. And we'd be in residence in this one community for the entire 5 weeks, and building relationships with community members, beginning to understand how they understood Jamaican history, and helping them understand how we use buildings as historical evidence. And so it was really very much a partnership with the local community to begin to explore how can we take what was, you know, a largely neglected and marginalized but historically rich community, and begin to tell a story about that community and expand that story not only just across Jamaica, which is the Yale book deals with the Jamaica, but the research expands also across the Caribbean, and my new research is taking us all the way to West Africa.
Yeah, I wanted to just take a step back since you're now making me aware you do this beyond, you know, all over the world. So what is gained in your view in studying architectural history? Why did you choose it?
Because I think actually, so architecture is, like archaeology, is the material record of history. And if we have eyes to see how we can actually interpret architecture, we can better understand everyday lives. Architectural history is often spun as research in the history of the product of a particular architect. I'm in no way interested in architects' production. I'm interested in everyday landscapes. And so I think it's really important for us to think about the ways that the historic built environment, in fact, is part of the historical record, not because it tells us about a patron or about an architect, but in fact, it tells us about everyday life.
And as far as the students that you're taking with you on this journey to Jamaica, what are some of their roles? What do they get to do?
Sure. So the field school in Jamaica has come to a close because that research project, we've established a nonprofit in Jamaica that's now up and running and continuing with that work. But when we were there, I would take students that had backgrounds in archaeology, in public history, in history, and then also just undergraduate students who had just a general interest in questions of art, architecture, and justice. And we would spend most of the time, I would teach them my building archaeology methodologies, and so they'd have to learn the history of the nail. I'm famous, actually, for a three-hour lecture on the history of the nail, and at the end of that three-hour lecture, my students are actually, well, they tell me they're enthralled. But it's important. I mean, there's these there's basic bits of history that one has to know, and then you can take that equipment to any built environment and begin to understand how that built environment intersects with everyday life, and particularly as it relates to questions of race or gender or religious belief, politics.
So tell me, Lewis, what's the history of the nail?
Yeah, you have to enroll in my class.
No, you don't have to do that. Okay.
Yep. We don't have time.
Okay. Well, are you going to do a book?
Wait, you hear the history of the hammer.
No, that's right. That's right. If I'm really going to turn it to politics, right? When you're a hammer, everything's a nail.
Yeah.
Yes. So the work in Jamaica, and that's come out in two books, one published by the University of the West Indies Press. I wanted to make sure that a local press, I had a partnership with a local press, as well as a book by Yale. Those books are now out, and my current research work is taking us to West Africa. And I have been building partnerships thus far in Ghana and in Senegal. And I have much of my work in West Africa has been built in partnership with this really fantastic international organization called Sites of Conscience. And so I'd encourage your listeners to go check this out. It was a fantastic nonprofit that was birthed out of South Africa, but it gathers together site leaders, museum directors that have from both Southeast Asia as well as Africa and now increasingly in the United States, sites that have really delicate political, social, racial, ethnic content These are challenging sites to oversee, and it's challenging to figure out what's exactly the right interpretive methodology to bring to a general public, particularly when your general public is going to be enormously mixed in terms of race, ethnicity, and gender. And so this organization brings these people together, and they share best practices, and I've been able to tap into that particular network of thought leaders from West Africa and begin to understand how those various sites that we think of as associated with the exportation of slaves, 11 million slaves that left West Africa in the early modern period, how do we tie those sites together, and how do we use architecture as a way of better understanding what the everyday experience of the individual was who was transitioning from a free human, a free person, and being made into the commodity of a slave? And how does this process work, and how does architecture play a role in that?
What kind of you're mentioning? You know, you need partnerships to move into these places, be it the Caribbean or Senegal. I'm just wondering what, how much of the time that you spend is spent earning people's trust and finding the right people, since it's obviously not in your backyard at this point.
No, that's right. I would say at least a third of my time is invested in relationship building and relationship maintenance, and this is a new methodology that is really central to a new generation of scholars who are working in the social sciences and the humanities, and that is community partnerships and coming to recognize that the community has a great deal to teach us and that we can't presuppose a respect from the community. We have to actually earn that respect, and that respect is a byproduct of relationships, time spent together. You have to earn trust.
Can I ask you a question about The Beauty of Holiness, the book that you wrote about Anglicanism and architecture in South Carolina, just a little bit? It won a Best Book Prize in 2010, and it piqued my interest because you're talking about sacred spaces, and anyone who's been to South Carolina, to Charleston, it's just gorgeous there. And just what can you tell us about that in the couple of minutes that we have left?
Sure. So The Beauty of Holiness was my first monograph. So that's now, you're taking me back more than 10 years ago. That's right. That was work from a long time ago. But that book is rooted in a study of the local textures of place. And actually, that's how I first got to Jamaica, because my dissertation director said, well, if you want to do work in South Carolina, you have to go study somewhere else first. So that when you get to South Carolina, you understand what's different and, you know, throw the local textures into high relief. And so that book really focuses on a kind of theoretical posture that religion is also material. And so frequently we think of religion as only books, ideas, text, sermons. And my argument in that book really is that religion is manifest in things, in stuff, and that there is the thing called material religion. But it's also, I mean, South Carolina in the 18th century is also a slave-owning population, and so the history of slavery plays a critical role in that book as well.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank you for being here. Lewis Nelson, Professor of Architectural History at UVA. It was really great to have you. Thank you.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting
me. Nice to meet you.
And I will say, if people are interested, just go to the UVA architecture site, look up Lewis Nelson. You'll see quite a lot more about his work and his titles.
Yes, there's a lot buried under the ground, apparently. a lot of secrets to be found.
Wait, what did you say, Lewis?
I just said yes, there's a great deal, and we should all go out and find it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes,
thanks
thank you
me.
For being
yes,
here.
Sure. You're welcome. Nancy.
Yes, Ellen, I do have a news of note. It's got three pieces, you know, three instances. It's our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. He's had a tremendous week. They've decided that their mission statement at the State Department should no longer say that we're promoting justice and democracy around the world. That's been stricken. So now we sound more like our foreign adversaries, that we're just focusing on self-protection and enrichment rather than, you know, some universal values. And then second thing he did was, whether you heard about it or not, but that Congress had appropriated for the State Department $80 million to counter ISIS propaganda and Russian disinformation, and he does not want that money to do those things because, you know, it would upset Co-President Putin. Seriously, because he said it would upset the Russians. He didn't want that money. It's still not to be. Anyway, I think he has till September before it officially vanishes, but he has said no to it so far. And the last thing he did was, of course, declare that he didn't like the sanctions either. You know, he was more concerned with Russia's reaction than the 755 U.S. diplomats that Putin expelled. So he is my very notable news. What do you got? Anything?
Give me a sec. Okay. We've got some stuff going on in the studio. Yeah, I have something really cool.
I know it's
and
technical.
This is,
you needed
this
more time.
Is, no, I don't. This is really cool. This is this group, Chicanos. They are called Las Cafeteras, or they're a band, Las Cafeteras. And they wrote this great song called If I Was President that I want to play. But something that's so great is their music is really interesting, that you'll hear it. And they went to, they became aware of a mother who had been in this country for 25 years, originally from somewhere else, maybe Mexico. And she goes in to check in with ICE every year. This year when she went in, she's been here, no problems, no criminal record. She has a child. Instead of the check-in, they put an ankle bracelet on her, and they threatened they were going to deport her. So this group went there, protested, sang a song, and because of that protest, she is now free for another couple of years at least, but I just wanted to play a little bit from that, from their piece. And here is just a little snippet.
If I was president, I'd roll up my sleeves as I face the congregation. First thing I do is free education. And every third period, yo, we practice meditation. Like a brown Robin Hood, I take from the rich and I give to the poor. So my little sister ain't gotta be hungry no more. And my first lady will be my mom's, cause she smacked me at the first start of drone strikes and dropping bombs. And if I was president, I'd free all my poor black and brown kids that got caught up in three strikes. And when they get out, they get free bites, so they can ride to their future, not to their past. Go to the store, get some chips with no GMO, cause my folks, we got a right to know. And if you don't know,
that was If I Was a President from Las Cafeteras. Check them out.
Yeah.
So, I wanted to, with no further ado, introduce our next guest. He is Seth Whispleway. He is the minister, directing minister at Restoration Village Arts. Their website just launched. It supports artists and ministers working within at least one of four currents: racial justice, eco-justice, queer justice, and borderlands justice. Welcome, Seth.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah.
So I wanted to mention restorationvillagearts.org is where artists can apply to be a part of your support, really. What is it that you will do for them, and explain, maybe by way of example, some of the people that you've worked with?
Sure. So Restoration Village Arts, we envision a just and beautiful world through arts and theologies, and we try to activate that through being a retreat, learning, and action community for artists and ministers who are creating resources within today's movements of liberation, specifically those four streams you mentioned. We intentionally put retreat first in that new mission statement, that for people, leaders who are on the front lines of creating resources, whether those are in the arts or in theology or in academia, or just in the public sphere, and we'll get to that in a little bit, it's hard to find the space when you're constantly on the front lines kind of seeking transformation, and we all need rest and recovery and generative space to do those things. So to give a couple concrete examples, one of our dear friends is Bree Newsom, who is most famous for taking the Confederate flag down from the State House in South Carolina shortly after Dylann Roof massacred all those churchgoers. And what many people don't know, perhaps, is that she is also a trained videographer and musician from NYU and has a lot of art to get out there. And so when she was commissioned to create a piece for the National Endowment for the Humanities big slavery event at Monticello last fall, September of 2016, Restoration Village Arts was able to create and open up the creative space. We have a music studio. We have a guest suite for her to create and generate a beautiful work of art that incorporated several African-American students from the University of Virginia, So we want to invest in our community, and that's where the learning and action piece comes in. Bree was able to retreat at Restoration Village Arts, create this this piece, and then we were able to bring along the community in that, and then it was delivered and performed at that event. And since that time, we've had a couple soft launch events to see, is this a viable and workable model? And the fill-to-capacity house concerts we've had for those artists have shown that it is, and that we've got a little something to give away here. And in doing so, we benefit, Restoration Village Arts does, by all those who now are plugged into stories and people and transformation going on that they might not otherwise have been. And so they hopefully keep coming back to us.
Thank you. We're talking with Seth Wispelway. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We'll continue talking with Seth. He is the directing minister at Restoration Village Arts, providing space for artists and ministers in the pursuit of social justice. I wanted to mention he's also a grassroots organizer, educator, and pastor himself. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Apropos of Something. I'm Ellen Daniels, and we have Nancy Lawrence, as always, coming to you from New York City. Today, we're talking with Seth Wispelway of RVA Restoration Village Arts.
Hey, Seth, I know that, you know, before you established the Restoration Village Arts, you yourself had an extensive background in public advocacy and activism. And I was just wondering if you could share a little of that, and also, did that work inspire the Restoration Village Arts, or are they two separate things?
That is a great question, and yes, true story. Prior to this year, I would say the majority of my so-called career has been as a grassroots organizer working for a variety of mainly global-focused NGOs, specifically at the intersection of college campuses, congregations, U2 concerts on a good day, and trying to make known to as broad of an audience as possible how our voices, our votes, can really mean transformation and life globally and at home when we wield them collectively. And there is a direct connection, probably in more ways than you realize when you ask the connection. So I've worked for, I was one of the original organizers for the One campaign. So I wasn't joking about U2 concerts. Then did a lot on farm, food, and trade policy with Bread for the World. Some more local work with Fair Trade Boston and the Boston Faith and Justice Network. Cobbled together a graduate degree in there. And then several years with the world's largest anti-modern slavery organization, International Justice Mission. But let me jump back real quick. My very first gig, organizing gig, was a small campus gathering at the University of Texas in Austin. I didn't know what I was doing. I had been in Texas for the first time in my life for a month. And this gig was a concert by a band called The Restoration Project. And the lead singer, songwriter for that band is now my spouse. And at the time, they were one of the, they did 200 shows a year, a lot of college campuses, had a nice little following, as well as a lot throughout Latin America. I didn't know anybody in Texas, so my spouse now, Tracy Howe, and her bandmate took me out for drinks, and we didn't really reconnect until a few years later. But Tracy, had her own calling that brought her, as I mentioned, throughout Latin America. She sings and speaks in Spanish and Portuguese as well as English, needed an entity to sort of equip her work and her music within communities that couldn't necessarily pay a rider for putting on a show in the way we often do in terms of venues here in the United States. She felt called to bring her songs and her songwriting workshops to women's prisons in Bolivia, to the favelas of Brazil, to Ciudad Juarez and communities of transformation and faith there. And so what is now Restoration Village Arts was her small nonprofit that we say she carried around in a wagon. And we got married in 2010. Sorry, I had to think about it there for a second. And
you'll have to deal with that later.
And have a, you know, through our fused worldviews and, you know, journeys together, have now kind of woven what was that wagon into a Mini Cooper with this mission I mentioned earlier. And so, you know, you unloaded a whole can of worms with that really great question. But in that sense, my grassroots organizing background, and I believe like Lewis does, who was speaking earlier, that how we tell our stories and how we reconcile or not with our past matters very much to what is going to be possible in terms of how we transform our future. And Restoration Village Arts wants to surface and foreground stories that are too often not being heard, either because amazing artists and musicians and ministers are too busy doing work on the front lines, or because structures of evil like white supremacy suffocate them. And so in our small kind of mom and pop way, we want to grant fund and come alongside those stories. And, you know, this summer especially has become a perfect storm for, you know, we barely got the website up and we kind of rushed its launch yesterday because as a grassroots organizer, now a minister myself, living in Charlottesville, which has become ground zero for so many overt expressions of white supremacy, we've become just a fulcrum for organizing a new kind of story and trying to use artists and faith leaders to do that.
Can you talk a little bit about the Clergy Collective, which you're a member of? Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and then what you're doing now, I think you began to talk about that.
Sure. So Charlottesville has an organization called the Charlottesville Clergy Collective that has been a convening entity brought together by Reverend Dr. Alvin Edwards a few years ago after the Charleston massacre, which I alluded to earlier, to make sure that clergy and faith leaders of all faiths here in Charlottesville, Central Virginia, are friends with each other and acquainted with each other and know who to turn to and call when things go crazy, as they certainly have this summer. This summer, for those who don't know, recently Charlottesville City Council, in a close vote, voted to remove one of our prominent Jim Crow era statues of Robert E. Lee from our most prominent downtown park. We have an array of statues from the Jim Crow era, and that being the most prominent. And so that's focused a lot of what we've seen nationwide in terms of empowered white nationalists, empowered, I would say, all the way up to the White House, descending on Charlottesville and increasingly volatile confrontations taking place in our public spaces. There was a Ku Klux Klan rally that received national and international media on July 8th, and we're preparing for an even more potentially combustible event on August 12th with this big Unite the Right rally. So because a lot of clergy and faith leaders did not feel equipped or feel like they had the training and discipline to be present in these kind of combustible spaces, me and my colleague Brittany Kane Conley formed an entity we call Congregate Charlottesville. We're not calling it a new organization. In fact, Restoration Village Arts is operating as fiscal sponsor for it. Congregate Charlottesville is an organizing mechanism to equip faith leaders with the and those who would follow them with the tools to stand up for justice, whether in urgent situations like this or in long, deep work within public structures or their own congregations. So we are faith-driven, mobilized for justice, acting together.
You know, specifically about that rally on the 12th, how will you get your message across from theirs, because theirs is being broadcast? I know you know this, you've been planning this, but, you know, they have speakers, they have sponsors, it sounds organized, so how will you get your message out there?
That is a great question as well. We are trying to out-organize. We, as Congregate Charlottesville, have put out a national call for 1,000 clergy and faith leaders to come to Charlottesville in body and or spirit. You know, I think realistically, we are hoping for at least a few hundred. And we are hoping to pull gravity away from that messaging mm-hmm. and those speakers. My understanding is that they don't have an amplification permit. But we're using the language of the civil rights movement. We have a mass interfaith prayer meeting Friday night, August 11th. And national leaders have heard this call. They recognize this as a critical national moment. It is being locally led. I want to stress that this has been a local invitation, as Charlottesville has had to grapple in real time with becoming ground zero for a lot of this. But at that service, August 11th, Dr. Cornell West and Reverend Dr. Tracy Blackman and many others are going to preach and speak, and we are working to tell a new story. And I think it's also worth mentioning, since it's wonderful that these prominent black leaders are coming to Charlottesville, that we're really stressing, though, that we want white clergy to come to Charlottesville, that white America in general has so much catch-up to do in terms of standing up. Lewis and I were having a conversation before going on air about how we believe it's the privilege of white people to message that these kind of things should be ignored, that just by being present as people of faith, people of influence, I'm talking about people who are white or identify as white, sends a message of solidarity, that our perspective, that we recognize that the violent ideology of white supremacy that seeks to dehumanize so many of our human siblings, black and brown people, queer folks, Muslims, immigrants, refugees, Jews, is unacceptable, that this inbreaking is unacceptable. And it's our hope and prayer. We are hoping for a little spiritual juju here, that standing up in a prophetic and nonviolent direct action kind of way there on the 12th will start to send that message that dismantling and overcoming white supremacy individually, congregationally, communally is all of our responsibility. And August 12th is a great day to start.
Well, I want to thank you for being here and giving that message. That's Seth Wispelway. His organization is restorationvillagearts.org. You can find all the information there, and you can apply to be an artist in residence as well. Thank you so much to Seth, and thank you, Lewis Nelson, for being here.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
I guess
they had
okay
fun,
then.
Maybe. They may have had some fun.
both of them. It's amazing. I think this is the second, maybe there may be more, but it seems like the last 2 weeks, accidentally, of course, but you, usually, have managed to get two guests on that wind up somehow, you know, relating to each other, though that was not the intent when we booked them, you know?
Yes, it was. No. Well, I guess that's the divine providence that sometimes happens.
Down to the fact that these two actually knew each other, if I may just go down this road for another half a second, which, you know, yeah. I know you planned it. I'm sorry. You planned it.
We didn't.
Show one.
We had this
all in line.
No, it's just great. It's great. A lot of connection here. And it's really great to build connection. That's happened as well. It's satisfying. So, and just everyone... I was going to say that this podcast will be available on the station website at 947wpvc.org.
And may I cleanse this palate cleanser rather with we have time, right? So
yes,
mine is a fashion designer, Kenneth Cole, has founded the EAC, which is End AIDS Coalition. It's this unprecedented nonpartisan collaboration of leading AIDS experts, policymakers, businesses, activists, humanitarians, all coming together with the mission of harnessing every innovation out there possible to end the AIDS epidemic by 2030 is their goal, which obviously... Mm-hmm. I wish them the expeditious good faith.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. I just wanted to mention voting again. It's not so much of a palate cleanser, but this is still, of course, persistent problem that we can't keep our eyes off of, I think, the whole Kobach thing. So pay attention to races, you know, vote. People are purging themselves from voting records because certain states, I think seven states, are giving the information to the government or the regime. So challenge, you know, lawyers stand up, get the backs of people challenged by the Justice Department, and local organizing is very important. So,
yeah, you know, I know I we had talked about it a few shows ago, and as you said, it is incredible. It is important. And I was thinking, you know, even if you check now, I still would want to check in October. You know what I mean? I just don't trust that the job, just like the health care bill, will not see, or at least the GOP's version, rather, will not go away. I feel like this voting thing is something you have to do, you know, more than an annual checkup, you know, because I just, they seem to have their ways of undoing no's from governors, you know?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to, again, thank our guests for being here. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're here every Saturday morning from 10 to 11. And I wanted to thank Keller Williams. I do not thank them enough. The Beckham team at Keller Williams, thank you so much for your support. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Finance.
Bye.
Bye.